Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Faith Radio Mornings. This is our first live broadcast of, dare I say, 2019. It's extremely hard to believe it's 2019, but happy new year to all of you listening this morning as part of the Faith Radio Network. I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner. Glad to be back in the chair again, live in studio for this morning after a good time off. I hope it was a great Christmas for all of you. I hope it was a happy new year. I know this time of year can be mixed emotions, where there's the excitement and the hopefulness of the future. There's also some awareness of the past and some of the things that I think we've lost and left behind as well. Life is a funny journey that is mixed with pain and joy, sorrow and sadness, but love and hope as well, especially as we are fixing our eyes on Jesus together, because we always are part of a kingdom that knows no end. And of course, I'm in studio with friends Rachel Sutton and Paul Perot, who do such a great job of producing the morning show every morning, bringing guests from around our country, even sometimes around our world, to bring their wisdom and insight into the topics of the day. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
Did you have a good New Year's? Did you make it all the way until midnight for the New Year's night?
I actually did, and my friends and I weren't sure we were going to, so we kind of celebrated at 9 o'clock and then 11, and then it was like, well, we're still here, so let's just stay till midnight.
I know, you can kind of cheat. We were FaceTiming some friends of ours in South Africa that was about 8 hours ahead, and they were already sort of celebrating. And there's that moment to say, hey, it's New Year's somewhere, right? Can we not just celebrate now and get to bed at a reasonable hour? But you made it all the way until midnight.
We did. We were playing card games, so, you know, why not stay a little longer?
Well, and I understand that you had some popper explosions that in past years, you were pointing some of these crackers right at your face when you were going to explode the confetti. Did you manage to sort this out for this year?
I did, and actually we didn't have any of those poppers this year, so I was safe.
Okay. Well, you can always YouTube stuff like that, I'm sure, to understand how to do that. Well, great to be back in studio with you. I know that we have our friend and first guest here of 2019, Drew Griffin of Providence Magazine, on the line as well. And Drew does such a great job editing and writing for Providence Magazine. It's providencemag.org, and it is a journal of Christianity and American foreign policy. And in just a moment, Drew and I are going to get into so many of the headlines around the world that are relevant, including the withdrawal out of Syria that President Trump put into play over the holiday season. But Drew's on the line now. Good morning, Drew.
Hey, good morning, Peter. How are you?
Doing well. Happy New Year. Did you have a good New Year's celebration?
You know, it was quiet. Happy New Year to you, too. It was quiet. It was peaceful. I was probably in bed by midnight, so I'm not a very exciting guy when it comes to that kind of thing.
Okay, so, but did you see the clock? All that matters is that you're there at 12:01, Drew. Did you see the clock click over to 12:01, or were your eyes closed prior to that?
No. I made it. I officially welcomed in the new year. Yeah, it's official.
That's great. Well, love having you on the program. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, I definitely am looking forward to your perspective on the withdrawal that created quite a bit of controversy over the holidays. And, of course, we saw the resignation of James Mattis as well, that President Trump went ahead and accelerated the timetable on that. So lots to get to with Drew Griffin next. Welcome back, everyone, to Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings here at about 9 minutes past the hour. You've already heard the voice of Drew Griffin of Providence Magazine. The website for which he writes is providencemag.com. It's a journal of Christianity and American foreign policy, and it's really a site that has substance and depth and complexity when thinking through so many of the topics of the morning. So, Drew, we referenced before the break this idea of the United States coming out of Syria, and it seemed to be a bit of a surprise when the headlines came out that even President Trump went ahead and went against the advice of many of his military leaders. Where do we stand on this, and what are you seeing in the situation?
Well, I mean, as at this moment, we stand that the United States is going to withdraw its around 2,000 troops out of Syria. It's troops that have been there for some time, helping prosecute the war against ISIS. They're part of a coalition of nations, NATO nations and European nations and other nations that are fighting against the Islamic State in Syria, pushing that state back. Before the holidays, before Christmas, before New Year's, as you referenced, President Trump kind of made an astonishing announcement, just kind of woke up and said, hey, we're going to withdraw our troops. ISIS has been defeated, released a video to that effect saying that ISIS has been wiped out. And this seemed to be somewhat was met with some surprise by people in Syria, by surprise by people in the Defense Department, no less than James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, ended up resigning in protest over this. And so it still stands as at this moment, the United States is going to pull its troops out of Syria and kind of vacate our position there. And it's still a very contentious topic in Washington.
Well, and you referenced, Drew, and you used the phrase that President Trump seemed to wake up and make this decision. And there's been quite a bit of criticism of the president over the past 18 months that he's relatively spontaneous and that he works relatively quickly and based on his gut feel. And I've always wondered, is this, you know, part of negative news coverage or is this really true of the president? But it seems like in all accounts, this really did take everybody by surprise. And it wasn't a long-term conversation that had been having prior.
Well, it's probably, I mean, there probably was a conversation that was being had somewhere inside the White House. It just didn't apparently happen to include, the leaders within the State Department and within the Defense Department. And as James Mattis said in his resignation letter, people who had, 30 and 40 years, multiple decades of experience in this region and experience with these types of issues, it didn't seem to include. I think part of the criticism is probably fairly leveraged at the president and at the White House when some of these decisions are made, not only maybe because of the substance of the decisions, but the way in which they are made. I think there are easier ways to roll these types of major decisions out. You get the backing of the policy experts behind you, and you present your case to the American people. And if you do that effectively, typically the American people can take that type of change. I think that there is a real tendency, though, on the part of President Trump's followers and on part of his supporters to say that, look, we've played it by the rules and we have had the same policy in the Middle East for years. Look at where that policy has gotten us. We've been at war basically with either ISIS or with Iraq or with Afghanistan or with Al-Qaeda, for the better part of 20 years. Thousands of Americans have lost their lives, tens of thousands of Syrians and Iraqis and Afghan fighters have lost their lives. And so where have all these policies gotten us? It's time for a change. And I'm not saying that that's not a valid criticism either. I think that there are elements of the U.S. Middle East policy that need to be altered and need to be changed. But I think that there's a good way to do that. And I think there's a way to do that that gets our allies on board. There's a way to do that that gets the American people on board. And that's the surprising thing, I think, about the Trump presidency is a lot of these major decisions seem to not only skirt the norms of decision making in terms of the substance of the policies, but they skirt the norms of how you roll these types of decisions out. And I think that what happens, unfortunately, maybe for the president, he kind of shoots himself in his own foot. Like he ends up causing more drama than I think is necessary. Perhaps that's part of his goal, perhaps not. I'm not sure. But I think that there are probably more effective ways to affect change in the Middle East.
Well, and as we head into 2019, Drew, we see now the departure of James Mattis, who is widely respected across both sides of the political aisle. We see that John Kelly's resignation, retirement as chief of staff here is imminent. And Nikki Haley, we knew she was leaving, but she is officially leaving her post as well. Who's left within the cabinet that's sort of seen that might be people of voices and reason and experience? Who do we have left and who is he bringing in?
Well, I think the voices of reason and experience, I would say at least experience, you still have men like John Bolton who are experienced, foreign policy professionals. There are a number of individuals within the State Department and kind of within the bureaucracy that have long-lasting experience. It's unclear, I think, yet who the president is going to who ultimately, I gotta say, is going to fill some of the posts that remain vacant. This kind of turnover is not uncommon within administrations, especially when you start hitting the 2 and 3 year mark. So I don't read a whole lot into other than Mattis, who resigned specifically in protest of a specific decision. A lot of these departures as some kind of condemnation or fatigue with the Trump administration. Washington is a moving place, and people are constantly shuffling around. And so it's I would say, though, that the president would be well served by people in these positions and in these prominent positions who have experience in their fields and have years and decades of experience in these fields, especially since the president, I mean, you know, just objectively does not. I mean, he is not a foreign policy expert. He's not even a political expert. He's a businessman. That's why a lot of people kind of supported him. He has not lived in Washington. He's not even traveled before his presidency to a lot of foreign countries. And so he would be well served to find people who can fill those positions and provide him with the benefit of their experience.
That's the voice of Drew Griffin this morning from Providence Magazine. It's providencemag.com is the website. Again, highly recommend going there if you want to read some substantive work on some of the foreign issues facing the United States of America. And Drew, you referenced ISIS as part of our conversation early on as well. And I know some of the motivation to be in Syria was just because of how disturbing some of the growth of ISIS was a couple of years ago. And now there's a suggestion that ISIS has been wiped out. But where is the leadership in Syria? And is ISIS still a threat? Could they sort of grow back into what they once were?
I think ISIS is still very much a threat. I think that they're, you know, this is kind of like, and I've heard some experts, I think, describe it in this way, that it's like if you're putting out a forest fire, you know, you don't just stop when the major flames die down, right? I mean, you have to literally kill out every ember that remains and extinguish it, or it will reignite. And I think that that's what we see here with ISIS, is that, you know, the major flames, it's no longer a raging fire. The major flames have been extinguished. The United States and its partners have successfully kind of put out the major, you know, news-making part of the fire and kind of restricted it into a certain area. But there are still embers there. And if the Syrian government that is now beginning to kind of reestablish control over its country fails to do that successfully, or if we give any safe haven or safe harbor or leave any area where those embers can get a little bit of oxygen, they will reignite. And, you know, power abhors a vacuum. The Middle East abhors a vacuum. If the United States withdraws from Syria, if we draw down our troops in Afghanistan, basically if we lift and lighten our footprint in that region, I'm afraid that we're going to give space for oxygen to kind of get in there, for the flames of that kind of Islamic fundamentalist, radicalist, and dangerous anti-freedom kind of a movement to reignite, and it could become very dangerous. And, you know, we look at all of the kind of ancillary side effects of these wars, of the refugee crisis that the war in Syria occurred, the effect that that's had on the politics within the European Union, the number of refugees that have tried to come into the United States, the number of Christians and Christian villages all across the Assyrian plain that have been completely decimated by ISIS, and Christians who are trying to flee that area and flee to the United States and flee to Europe. We look at all of those side effects, and those things didn't happen in a vacuum. They happened because, you know, we withdrew from Iraq. They happened because we allowed these small leaders and these small, we would say, insignificant, you know, factions to gain a foothold, and in doing so and saying, well, that's not our problem, that's Iraq's problem, that's Syria's problem, that's someone else's problem, and taking that approach, you know, we allow these things to fester, and the side effects are really damaging. So there's real argument, I think, for America to use its power and its prestige to stay engaged in the Middle East and to stay engaged in Syria and to stay there really until ISIS is completely extinguished, to the best that we can.
Well, I certainly suspect that there's going to be a lot of conversation in 2019 about this very situation. We certainly haven't seen the last of it. Again, it's Drew Griffin who's joining us here for the 2nd of January, talking about some of the issues facing American leadership around the world. And Drew, when we come back, let's change the subject to Saudi Arabia. I see there's some maybe subtleties in some changing of Saudi leadership, and I want to get your perspective on that relative to what's happening in the war in Yemen and the murder of the journalist Khashoggi. So lots to get to with Drew Griffin next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. We're chatting with Drew Griffin first here on the 2nd of January and part of the new year of 2019. And Drew does such a great job covering the news from a foreign, just the foreign events of our world from a Christian perspective. And Drew, we are talking before the break a little bit about Syria. And there's other news coming out of the Middle East, specifically in Saudi Arabia, where it sure appears that there's a bit of a shakeup in the leadership within the Saudi Arabian cabinet. What do we see there?
So what we see really is kind of the typical reaction to a major, kind of PR disaster is a reshuffle of staff. You know, every political operation will do this, campaigns in the United States and the administrations in the United States. Something goes wrong. What do? You kind of blame the staff and begin to shuffle it around. And that's really what we see here in Saudi Arabia. Before in October, as we've covered and we've talked about, the and our intelligence services have affirmed Saudi Arabia and specifically His Royal Highness, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, ordered the death and dismemberment of a critical journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, who was a United States resident. This occurred in Turkey. And when it was found out and when he disappeared, it was a major international uproar and really turned all of the kind of limelights onto Saudi Arabia and the fact of their just horrendous human rights record. And so in an effort to try and kind of stave that, those individuals who kind of handled the PR basically for the kingdom in the initial stages of that crisis have been relieved and that new people have been put in their place, basically. And so there's just been a major reshuffle, trying an effort on the part of Mohammed bin Salman to control the story and kind of put a good face for Saudi Arabia out there. This is all part of his Vision 2030 effort, which is a major initiative that Saudi Arabian government has to create a modern state that is not only kind of more politically acceptable to the rest of the world, but really is a venue for investment, for foreign investment. And so anything like the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, like the prosecution of the proxy war in Yemen, any of these things that kind of endanger that vision 2030 and endanger their creation of a viable state for kind of foreign investment and ingenuity, anything that can threaten that needs to kind of be squashed. And so that's kind of what we see here. Is just some hiring of new staff and repositioning of staff. Some of whom Ibrahim Assaf, who was one of the individuals that prior to his assumption of power, Mohammed bin Salman had actually locked up in the Ritz-Carlton. They're kind of sequestered with a number of other kingdom officials before he took power. So it's been a little bit shocking that he's even people that he used to were on the outs with him. He has now brought them in to kind of run the government. But it just shows the extent to which he's willing to go to try and control the story.
And Drew, we have a couple minutes left relative to this, too. You referenced the 2030 initiatives. How does the political structure work in Saudi Arabia? The Crown Prince could be there and leading that for quite a long time, couldn't he?
Yes, I mean the structure is enormously complex, and it's hard really for us in the West and for us on the outside to give a whole lot of detail. I mean it's a little bit of a black box. It's very cryptic how the kingdom of Saud is run and how the royal family, which is enormous and really huge and occupies thousands of members and thousands of positions within the government from the bottom to the top, how that family actually does shake out. What we do know is that the Crown Prince has been named basically kind of the regent and kind of the ruling authority now. And yeah, he can stay in this position until until he dies. And he's a young man. He's 35, 36. He's in his mid-30s. And he was not a traditional choice on the part of King Salman, who appointed him. And so it's, he could be there for a number of years.
Drew Griffin of ProvidenceMag.com. Drew, before I let you run, I got to ask a question. Are you a New Year's resolution guy, and did you make any for the upcoming year? And if you didn't, you can do that right now live on air, Drew.
Oh, see, I knew you were going to ask me this. I knew it, and I thought, you know, I'm not much of a New Year's resolution guy, but I should try and come up with, you know, with something. I could just say, you know, I resolve to kind of be kinder and gentler to people. Maybe that, you know, that's a easy thing to say. But this is so difficult. But I would say, you know, my main resolution this year is to be a better husband and father, which is always a difficult thing for me, considering all the things I have to do. But that's definitely, I think, probably the top on my resolution list.
Well, I would suggest that is quite admirable. I know at the end of the day, it's family and friends and relationships that stand the test of time. And love your perspective, love your wisdom and insight and all of what you bring to Faith Radio Mornings, Drew. It's great to talk with you again.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Happy New Year. It's good to be with you.
We'll take a break here on Faith Radio Mornings for some lighten up and some bottom of the hour news. And we come back for the second half of this hour. I'll be joined by friend Adam Carrington. And we certainly have a lot to get into as the 2020 election cycle has already started. Well, as you would imagine, there's any number of headlines coming out of New Year's Eve and New Year's Day events around our country and our neighbor here to the east in Waukesha, Wisconsin. A Waukesha woman says she is going to have a talk with her guard dog about who he snuggles with after making a strange discovery in her home. The woman woke up early Tuesday morning and found a strange man snuggling and sleeping alongside her 120-pound puppy. Investigators say the man had too much to drink on New Year's Eve, walked into the wrong home, and fell asleep, but the dog never made a sound. So this would be a good indication, maybe a New Year's resolution, is to have some conversations with our animals about protecting our homes.
When someone says to you, "But that's just your interpretation of the Bible," how do you respond? This is Jim Garlow. My doctoral studies were in historical theology, in other words, how beliefs develop over time, throughout church history. It's true some of the secondary beliefs have changed over the centuries, but it's remarkable how core biblical values have stayed largely intact for several thousand years, and across very different cultures. So when someone challenges your interpretation of the Bible, here's what's important for you to know. Let the Bible speak for itself. It doesn't speak to every specific situation, but it gives the necessary moral framework to be applied to every situation. These are days in which we'll all need to be seriously well-versed in what Scripture has to say. To be well-versed in what the Bible says and what it means, you can at jimgarlow.com. Let the Bible speak for itself.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings at about 23 minutes before the top of the hour. And that music means that we are being joined by good friend of the program, Dr. Adam Carrington, who teaches political science at Hillsdale College. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Paul. I'm sorry, I was talking to your producer. Good morning, Peter. I hope you're all having a good new year.
We are indeed. And, you know, we often think that we should change Rachel's name to Mary. So we could be Peter, Paul, and Mary around here. You know, there's enough confusion to go around then.
I'd like to see how you all duet together then.
Well, that would make for a bad New Year's resolution to start singing this year for me, Adam. I'm completely tone deaf. But did you make any profound and strong New Year's resolutions for 2019?
I made some ones I should keep. We'll see if they're going to happen. But I'd say pretty mundane ones. Read my Bible more consistently, or you know, not let it happen in in more busy times. Also, eat a little better, exercise a little more. Those are all, I think, things a lot of people make, but we'll see how I stick to them.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I tend to make those same New Year's resolutions about every June, July, August as well. It never seems to end. Well, really grateful to have you back on the program. I assumed that you were probably going to be jumping into the political fray in 2019. It seems like there's about 40-some-odd candidates on the Democratic side of it that will be part of the presidential election cycle. Are you going to throw your hat in the ring at them?
Well, it seems like if everybody's doing it, I might as well. Confession, I'm actually not quite old enough to run quite yet, although I will be to admit my age a little later this year. But I think I'll be staying out of that fray. That seems like that is going to be a drawn-out, long, probably nasty race with lots and lots and lots of candidates. Like you said, I think there will be minimum of a dozen. And with the announcement that the Democratic Party made that they'll be having debates as early as June this year, I think it's clear that the election, as early as we think each election cycle gets, the next one seems to start just a little earlier.
Well, and certainly a pretty big name in Elizabeth Warren decided to enter into the fray pretty early on this one. And some of the thinking on that was that she lost a bit of momentum and needs to try to recapture it before it gets too crowded.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right to say that this is more of a sign of worry and maybe a little bit of weakness for her to jump in at this point. And I think it is tied to the fact that she had a pretty bad rollout trying to argue that she somehow had sufficient Native American heritage to make the claims that she did, that has been sort of made her the source of a lot of mockery from the political right. I think that she's also just not worn well. You see some of the polling, and she has pretty high negatives among Democrats for a candidate, for a Democratic front-runner candidate. Now, when I say that, she's, of course, in positive territory with Democratic voters, but it's interesting that she has much higher negatives than, say, Biden or Cory Booker or, you know, some of these other people that are expected to jump into the race possibly as well. And I think her jumping in so early is trying to maybe restate or reshow herself because she hasn't gotten off to a great pre-running footing.
Well, I think one of the more interesting names on that side of it, too, is Beto O'Rourke, in the sense that here's a guy who lost the senator race in Texas and yet seems to have some of that kind of early promising momentum that President Obama ultimately enjoyed after he gave the speech at the convention that year and kind of rode that to victory. Is he going to maybe throw his hat in the ring, or is maybe potentially losing the moment? What do we see for him?
That's. I wish I had a better handle or a better reading on him in as a person. And what I mean by that is maybe there are some family or other reasons that he may decide not to run. By the way, that happened in 2012 with Mitch Daniels, the former governor of Indiana. There were family reasons that he decided not to run. But I think as far as his moment, I think that this is as good a shot as he would ever have. Now, yes, he lost the Senate race, but as far as expectations, for you to come out and say that I lost as a Democrat running as a progressive in Texas by 2 points is actually, I think, something you can pitch to everyone else. And I think it's going to be part of what some Democrats are pointing out, that the liberal but not more socialist wing of the Democratic Party, and like I said, some people have written on this, are really looking to someone like him who is not quite as left-leaning, who is positive, who is charismatic, as a kind of standard bearer, and they're not sure whether they have that yet as far as a younger person. Biden might be that as far as an older generation, but in addition to just how many candidates there are, there is going to be the question, do Democrats want to go with a younger face who seems like a new, fresh generational person, or do they want to go with someone who's more tried and true? I think they're probably going to want to go more with the former, but we'll see how that plays out.
Well, and Adam, how much does the ability to raise funds play into who ultimately gets the nomination? If I remember correctly, O'Rourke raised quite a bit of money, $60, $70 million or something in his race in Texas.
Money matters a lot, and it matters a lot both for just the ability to run an operation, to be able to run campaign ads, to have campaign staff, to do all of the things that make campaign travel and other things workable, but also money signals support, that if you're getting a lot of either big donations from powerful party leaders, or if you're getting a lot of small donations from grassroots or both, those are signs of broader support beyond just the making of the money. They're signs that people are behind you, that they want you in. So it is going to be very interesting what candidates maybe have other good qualities but get snuffed out because they're not able to win the fight for a lot of the big donors that are out there. And that becomes harder when you get 12 or more candidates running. There are only so many donors, even if you have a large donor base in the Democratic Party. So that will be a very interesting part of the race, in addition to who has the better talking points, who gives the better stump speeches. That's about as important as those components.
That's the voice of Adam Carrington, who teaches political science at Hillsdale College and joins us regularly to talk about the scope of the political scene here in the United States. And Adam, if we go to the other side of the aisle, we see maybe some rumblings out of somebody like a Mitt Romney or a Jeff Flake. Is there any precedent for an incumbent president to really face a threat relative to the reelection cycle? Do we see somebody emerging to challenge President Trump?
Well, I'll start with the historical question, and the answer is yes, although in modern times it's rare. Two instances. One, 1992, Pat Buchanan ran against George H.W. Bush and caused some problems, more just headline headaches, because he was able to get a decent number of votes, but never really seriously challenged the ability to actually win the nomination. The more serious one was in 1980, Ted Kennedy running against then-sitting President Jimmy Carter, who came much closer. And I think that those kind of challenges, if they are serious, end up not succeeding, because there's a lot of incumbent power for a president, but they show the weakness of a candidate if they're able to draw a significant number of votes. That said, I think that the situation would have to be a lot different a year from now for that to happen with the president. And President Trump right now is still very popular with his base. A run from a Jeff Flake or a Mitt Romney would be a run from the part of the Republican Party that has either left the party or is not in control and not the bigger part of the party. And I think because of that, I don't see a run against Trump coming from that direction. And I think the current circumstances, you'd have to see the economy collapse or some other collapse in his support that just hasn't manifested itself yet for any run like that to be serious. I'm not saying one of them might not run, but I don't see it going anywhere unless things change.
Well, and it's been interesting to see Romney emerge, and it wasn't too long into the Senate-elect cycle that he decided to have some pretty critical words of the president. And again, Adam, from a historical perspective, do we have the kinds of precedent in which somebody who once ran for the presidential office and then later was elected to the Senate in this situation? It seems fascinating to watch.
That is also very rare, and I don't know too many examples of it. If you go way back, John Quincy Adams in the early 19th century ran for president, won, lost his reelection bid, and then went into the House of Representatives. So it happens a little bit, but typically when people run, they don't for president, they don't run for another office. So this will also be interesting. And for Romney, it's going to be the further wrinkle is coming out of Utah. The politics of Utah just are a little bit different. They have not been as in favor of President Trump and his politics as Republicans as most of the rest of the country has been. So Romney is sort of thinking on several levels, as a former presidential candidate, as a current senator that has to work with the party and the president, but also with a constituency that's a little less overwhelmingly supportive of the president than the Republican Party at large. So his is a very special case, and it'll be interesting to see how he tries to maneuver, because he said some good things about the president recently. He just wrote an op-ed that was much more critical, and it's a narrow road that he's trying to hoe, and we'll see if he can do it.
Well, it's certainly there's no shortage of things to talk about relative to the election cycle. And Adam, when we come back in just a moment, let's change the topic over to the current situation on the budget and the border wall battle and whether we're going to see some of the workers within the federal government go back to work anytime soon. So more with Adam Carrington next here on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. We're chatting with Adam Carrington this morning about some of the headlines coming out of the political scene in Washington, D.C. And Adam, there's a lot of people that are out of work right now because of the partial shutdown of the federal government. And it sure sounds like it may get even more extensive from here with not much of an end in sight. I know the president did tweet something yesterday to try to make a deal, perhaps with the new leadership in the House. But where do we stand in this entire situation?
Right now, I don't think the parties are very close to each other at all, and I think that really it's tomorrow that the House of Representatives switches to the Democratic Party. They are planning on passing a continuing resolution, which basically will just keep the government funded at its current levels with no changes, and use that as the beginning of a bargaining chip for going forward. And really, I think I don't see anything happening now until really the public opinion starts to decisively shift one way or another. Both sides, I think, are trying to play the blame game right now, but I think with the Christmas and New Year's holiday, a lot of the American public hasn't been paying as close attention. Those who have, unlike me, who have normal, sane lives and don't follow politics all the time. But I think the American people will, and especially as federal workers that have been furloughed start to miss paychecks, which would happen about a week from now, then you're really going to start to see some more reaction. And who gets blamed? Who's got the stronger positioning? I think there's some early sketches of that, but we'll see who makes the better argument. But that means that I don't think anything's happening in the next couple of days based on anything I've seen.
Well, and what is the president really looking for here, Adam, relative to the wall? Because I've seen a number of different what seem to be almost conflicting headlines coming out of his administration as well as him. We've started with this massive concrete barrier. Some people are suggesting it's a slatted fence. There's differences in how much it's going to cost. I saw that Nancy Pelosi poked some fun at him and said that maybe it was a beaded curtain. And so where do we stand with what this wall is that he wants and what he wants it to do?
I think that on this operates on two levels. One, I think the president does have a commitment to border security, and he believes that this is a fundamental campaign promise that he needs to keep. And I think that leads to the second, which is I think he wants something that both increases border security as he thinks is the best way to do it, but also is seen as a sufficient keeping of his campaign promise. Because one thing to also keep in mind is the White House had basically signed off on a funding bill that did nothing for the wall, and then there was a lot of opposition, basically a mini revolt among those who were supporters of the president that were especially concerned about immigration, people like Ann Coulter, and the president basically reversed his position. So I think the real thing to watch is what does the president think he can do that, yes, helps border security, but is enough that he can say that in doing so, he also kept his promise to build the wall. And I think some of this differing language that's being thrown around is a little bit of the administration trying to see what will work, what will come across as fulfilling his promise. Does it have to be a wall along the entire border? Does it have to be a wall in particular places? What does the wall have to look like? And I think partly because of the president thinks as much as he does in PR terms, seeing what will be palpable to his base is a little bit in flux. And I think that's part of why there's a little bit of back and forth going on about it.
Well, and relative to the president, too, it doesn't seem like he has as many spokespeople left within his cabinet. That would be some of the bigger names that could represent the situation as well. We saw the departure of Mattis and Kelly and Haley over these past few months. So where do we stand with the president's cabinet and who's sort of left standing relative to that situation?
I think the main driver of immigration policy at this point is Stephen Miller. I think he's the main one that is pushing things as far as a harder line. He is the one that's stuck things out. And I think you're right that with the significant changes in the cabinet, I think it presents two difficulties for the president. One, the fact that he's seems to be having trouble replacing people. For example, he still has not found a permanent replacement for his chief of staff. He just has Mick Mulvaney as a acting chief of staff. He also just the fact that that reorders the way that the administration is being run, even once you replace them. Changes in personality usually entail changes in at least partly in policy. So I think that the president is going to continue. It's going to be a difficult road until he gets people in place that both are competent and support his message. And I think that what you saw with Mattis and others is that he maybe had people that were competent, but not people that necessarily agreed with his own policies. So I think it just shows that the president will be playing with a smaller hand maybe than he could play until he gets all those things together. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out.
And Adam, we have just about 30 seconds left. Is this a pretty common phenomenon, though, that we see after the midterm election cycle, a shift in some of the cabinet members like this?
It is typical to have some leave. Now, I have looked at some statistics. The president has had higher turnover over the last 2 years and quicker turnover than really any administration in the last half century. But it is not untypical for some people who started out in the administration at the beginning to leave after the midterms. It's the fact that so many have left before the midterms that has really upped his percentage, not that some people are leaving after. That is fairly typical.
Well, it's great to hear your voice again, Adam. I certainly appreciate you joining us as you do here on Faith Radio Mornings, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you all as well.
We'll take a quick pause here and wrap up our first hour of the show and preview what's coming up on hour two here for Faith Radio Mornings. Well, that is hour one in the books here on Faith Radio Mornings. Certainly a lot to get to from the news perspective, and we couldn't have better voices than people like Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine, as well as Adam Carrington, professor of politics at Hillsdale College, walking us through so many of these important topics of the day. Well, up next here in hour two, it's a Wednesday, and that means that Bill English of BibleandBusiness.com is going to join us, and I see he's already out waiting. And Bill has some challenges for those of us in the business world to think about some resolutions we can make for the year ahead.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.